Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this. Don't tell me. Diphenhydramine hydrochloride, which is what? What's the brand name of that?
I have no
Benadryl.
Idea.
Benadryl.
Oh, okay. I think I've taken Benadryl a couple times, but almost purely for recreational purposes.
Do people really take that for recreational purposes?
I don't know.
I take it to go to sleep, and actually that is a medical indication for
I do remember once I had a beer and some cold medicine, and that was a really good night. That worked well.
I bet you slept like a baby.
It was like a Sudafed. Well, no, I tried to walk
around. Oh, but
around.
Sudafed, no, is a derivative of adrenaline. So actually, Sudafed does not put
well,
you
see,
to
there
sleep.
You go. So
that was like a Red Bull vodka.
Two beers and a Sudafed. Well, this was back in the 90s before that Red Bull vodka thing really took off.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the Red Bull vodka.
So you teased our subject today last week.
Yes.
You
drugs.
Said marijuana more
marijuana.
Than a few times.
Yeah. But and what I was pointing out was that I was...
Are you on the pot right now? Are you smoking the dope?
No.
Are you huckling the weed?
Really? Huckling the weed? What is this? Something out of
have you
Mark
smoked,
Twain?
Smoked a bone? Have you downed
a
spliff?
I thought it was smoke a bowl. Smoke a bone. I don't understand the... What's a blunt? Is that just like a really fat joint? I don't know.
There is no reason whatsoever to try and get knowledge from me about the slang of
the
drugs.
Drug culture.
I have done them, mm-hmm. but I do not know how to talk about them.
Oh, okay.
I believe, though, a blunt is tobacco in a cigar of some kind, or like a cigarillo.
Oh, so there's nothing to do with marijuana culture?
Did I say? I think I meant to say marijuana. Marijuana in a cigar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of weed, man. That's probably
No. I mean, the mixture of tobacco and marijuana.
Oh, okay.
Like hollow it out a little bit and then get it in there so you mix the smokes.
Right.
Back when I used to roll joints mm-hmm. a lot, which was a brief period of time in my life, but I rolled a lot. I would use half tobacco, half schwag. You know, to get a...
Schwag?
Well, like the crumbled bits at the bottom of a bag.
I didn't know that had a name.
It might not. Like I said, don't ask me for the knowledge. are you dying?
I'm just like, oh, that was smooth. I did learn something interesting at the 420 Festival.
What'd you learn?
And it's the whole nature of drugs, right? And when I say drugs...
Well, no, that's a big topic.
We are just, I mean, unless you're Mormon, we're all doing drugs. We're all doing drugs.
Surely the Mormons take aspirin and whatnot.
They might. Maybe the Christian Scientists don't. But the Mormons
don't
believe in caffeine.
Don't they drink hot chocolate? Hot chocolate, though. That's okay. You can buy hot chocolate in Salt Lake City.
You can buy anything in Salt Lake City, including getting a decent microbrewed beer.
Holly Golightly and the Brokoff said that they had a hard time finding a coffee shop in Salt Lake City.
So I don't think that's true.
They drank a ton of hot chocolate.
I've been in Salt Lake City. You can find coffee shops. And you can find microbreweries.
And then they played the song Getting High for Jesus, and the show was shut down.
What show is this?
Holly Golightly and the Brokoffs is a band.
Oh. The tour got shut down?
The show at the Salt Lake City venue got shut down after they played the song.
And what is
Getting
the
High
nature?
For Jesus.
Is that one of their songs? Getting High for Jesus? What is the nature of Getting High for Jesus? What is the meaning of their lyrics?
I'm getting high for Jesus because he got so low for me.
What does that mean exactly?
Well,
it doesn't
which
necessarily
part are
sound
you?
Disrespectful. I mean, no.
I don't know what to tell you.
Wait, but I'm guessing this band did not have a lot of Mormons in the audience. No?
Well, Pete.
What do you mean they shut the... Who's they? The venue?
First off, I was at the Earl, drunk. Right. Listening to this band, and they were telling a story about Salt Lake City. So all details are fuzzy.
Okay.
On top of that, it was just stage patter.
Okay.
Before they sang Getting High for Jesus. They were in Salt Lake City. They couldn't find a coffee shop, so they were drinking hot chocolate the whole time they were there. They were all geeked out on hot chocolate.
What year was this that you were at the Earl?
2008.
Yeah, but
so then they would have done the tour
Salt
before
Lake City,
that.
Even like the... mid-90s, and you could find microbreweries, you could find coffee shops. They may not be as prevalent as they are in other big cities, but...
I find it funny that you're actually having trouble running with this story because...
Okay, it was just their experience. No, but the point is, I don't want to bash the Mormons or Salt Lake City.
Why not?
I told a Mormon joke at a comedy club in Salt Lake City, and it was very well received, and so did the opener and the headliner that went on before and after me. Mormons have more of a sense of humor than you think. Well, that's what I learned.
You'd have to.
I would have to, definitely. Look, I was raised Catholic. You have to have a sense of humor to deal with some of the stuff
or,
that happens.
Or a frightening sincerity.
Yes. But I got to tell you, the Mormon view, you know, your body's a temple, no caffeine, no nothing. I'm digging that. I'm respecting that. That's one way to go.
I wish that I had treated my body a little bit more like
a
temple.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are thinking the Mormons have the right view. But I'm not going to give up my cup of Earl Grey in the morning. I like a cup of tea.
Yeah, but
I'm
going to
have a little
thing.
Caffeine. No, how is it different? I am self-medicating when I get up in the morning.
No, I'm saying that's a different thing than not treating your body well versus the cup of tea. I mean, I'm talking about the tons of fast food hamburgers that I've eaten in my life.
And let's consider that a drug as well.
all the terrible food.
Aren't you trying to be better? Don't you eat more roughage?
I try to be better now, but I've had 41 years, you know, to really screw it up.
Okay.
Especially that 27 to 35.
Okay.
Like, just bad news. I think that's right. 35? What year was 35 for me? No, 27 to 33.
Okay.
Trouble. Just bad.
Okay, but none of us are perfect, which is why this is a judge-free zone.
Is it? I judge you all the time.
You bastard.
So why do you want to talk about drugs and humanities and
science
books?
Well, I was wondering, is there a different view about drugs between scientists and those in the humanities?
There must be, right?
One would think so, but there is a paucity of research on the subject. I did do a cursory look
before. Did you just put on a British accent to say paucity?
When I say paucity, that's how I say it, of course. It's when I say cursory or Marmite.
is that the chocolate stuff?
Marmite is the heavy brown yeast extract that people in England eat. In Australia, they eat the lighter stuff. That's called Vegemite.
Oh, yeah.
But I will admit... even though it sounds disgusting, they make a snack food over there called a Twiglet, and it's a Marmite-coated pretzel, and the Marmite makes the pretzel very, very salty, and I actually love them. It's really, really good.
Well, speaking of drugs, Nick Cave said when he came over to America that the food here is unfathomable.
Where's Nick Cave from?
Australia, and then Europe in general. Like, he's lived all over, but I think he lives in England now. And he is Australian by birth.
Okay, what did he mean by that? That he can't fathom the nature of our food because it's just that good?
No, I would say the exact opposite.
Yeah. I think American food, when did he say this? 20 years ago. It's kind of boring.
No, just a couple of years ago. And
I mean, anyone that eats meatloaf for an entree, I don't get that.
You don't like meatloaf?
I'm not a big meatloaf
guy. I love meatloaf.
But you like meatloaf with some spice in it, some zest, something interesting?
I'll eat a meatloaf sandwich on white bread with ketchup.
Oh, no wonder you're going to die young. Is that part of that 27 to 33 years?
I believe I've missed out on my chance to die young. I think that's over now.
Okay. But you have missed out on the opportunity to leave a good-looking corpse. It's already done.
If you had to stereotype science and engineering types and their attitude towards drugs, what would you do? If you had to paint with a broad brush.
I don't think I can.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. Like, it feels like, oh, yeah, there's going to be a different attitude. But really, people are just people, right? And your profession or the way you treat your values of work, you know, and your values of, well, I don't know, like work. And then what's the other thing? If you are a scientist by trade, you might approach your daily life differently. You might approach your day-to-day with a slightly different attitude than if you're an artist. In the sense that you might think of different things when you're making your choices. You might use metaphor differently day to day, or you might create a narrative that has different milestones when you approach things day to day.
But I always assumed that all artists believed in anything that could expand their mind and their creativity.
I would say that that is not true any more than all people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it may not be. And some scientists have that view as well. Probably the most notable among them would be Nobel Prize winner Kerry Mullis, who actually has a joint appointment.
Wait. You're jumping ahead. Why do you think artists... Why would you think that artist thing about the expanded...
Purely anecdotal. Tune in, turn on, Timothy Leary, all this kind of thing. A lot of comedians do drugs. I've seen it in green rooms.
So
I have some stories.
Would you say scientists don't do drugs?
I think they do. Well, they do drugs a lot less than comedians. I work with a lot of scientists and engineers, and I work with a lot of comedians. And trust me, drug use is much more prevalent among comedians.
I feel like the thing that you're seeing is the difference between the facade you have to put up. You know, I don't think that there are a lot of punk rock scientists out there who can wake up at noon and come strolling into their place of work and maybe decide to end a day early because they're hungover or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Whereas you could do that as a self-employed artist. You know, if you have your own studio, you can lose a day to your drinking, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that punk rock is automatically a drinking kind of lifestyle, but
music preference, according to some of the studies we're looking at here, was a robust predictor of drug attitudes and drug use.
A lot of times, nightlife professions, you know, service industry and I want to say showmanship. You know, you are working at night. You're basically given a pass. You know, you don't have to wear a tie to work. You don't have to, fulfill the role that's given you.
I can tell you for a fact.
The corporate handbook.
I can tell you for a fact why many comedians self-medicate after a show. Because the adrenaline.
Are we calling it self-medicating now as opposed to just getting screwed up?
No, yeah. A lot of, they'll do it with marijuana. They'll do it with other drugs. A lot of them do it with alcohol. In fact. Very many of them do, because very often the club that you're at will at least give you some bit of a bar tab. But I know for a fact why that happens, because and this has been shared with me from everyone from Alonzo Bowden to other comedians. You're on such a high naturally from a good set, it's hard to go to sleep.
The reentry.
Yeah. So a lot of comedians stay up drinking late, eating hot wings. They don't have the greatest diet, kind of like you. But they do eventually have to go to sleep. Here's why. Because some yahoo wants them on their 6 a.m. radio show. And I've had comedians on my radio show back when Inside the Black Box, now Wednesdays at noon here on WRK, was on Radio Sandy Springs. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning on Sunday.
And people were like, look, I just can't. I can't do it.
And I did get a couple guys to come on the program at 9 o'clock in the morning on Sundays. So, it's not just between scientists and engineers necessarily. Okay, and maybe you're right.
Doing drugs on the day shift just doesn't seem like a lot of fun. That just seems
so
like
if you
more
are flipped,
work to hide.
And that is highlighted in an article entitled Musicians' Perception of Widespread Drug Use Among Musicians.
Because you know what I just remembered?
What?
They're illegal. I kind of forget.
But if you include alcohol or you include cannabis in a place like Colorado or Washington,
except,
then they're not.
I mean, yeah, but there's a lot of the stuff that goes on around drinking.
Historically, that is true.
Yeah.
I mean, supposedly Louis Armstrong smoked weed, so.
Not supposedly. Oh. He did.
Well, the point is, I wasn't there,
a
so I'm going to call it supposedly. Charlie Parker had a real big substance abuse problem.
He did.
But he was a brilliant musician. My brother's a sax player, and we have played some of his tunes together. Very, very talented guy. But the conclusion of this article by Chris Chesky and John Hippel is that the strongest link to perception of drug use among musicians was musician type. So this was their strongest indicator. Non-classical musicians were more likely to report widespread drug use compared to classical musicians.
I think that if you're on the
edge... non-classical musicians are more of the day job kind of person. You know?
If you're on the edge of cultural change,
right.
It's a hard life, and you're going to want to ease the pain in some way.
But we're talking about drug use for a totally different reason. That's drug use to ease the pain of life. That is self-medication
right.
for just difficulty, depression,
yeah,
anxiety.
But if you're a jazz player in the 50s and, you know, you're you're essentially a marginalized class. And then on top of that, you're probably dealing with institutional racism, because I think I think jazz players at that time were more black than white, right?
Can we give the bulk of the credit for jazz to black people? Let's just do that.
Yeah, well, we should do that for sure.
Okay.
But then I think there were
some cool white guys like Dave Brubeck that came along, but the bulk of it came from black music.
I forget who said it, but like, you know, in 1930 something, Benny Goodman was one of the hippest people in the world.
He might have been the hippest white person in the world.
No, this is what the person was saying. It's like, you know, Benny Goodman.
Was this a white person?
Oh yeah. No. The speaker was a black person.
Wow. I'm impressed.
But Benny Goodman, I mean, I think he had I'm going to get all this wrong. There's no reason for me to delve into this and just make stuff up.
Okay.
But.
That's never stopped you before.
It has.
Okay.
On occasion. But only rarely.
Is this a factoid you're giving me?
I was about to go into factoid land, and I decided to stop.
Okay.
But it's true that big band swing, which is what Benny Goodman was all about, mm-hmm. right, is not the jazz that we're talking about.
Yeah.
That is a African-American art form mm-hmm. in many ways. You know, right. Jazz and the blues, right, are basically right. invented, refined, and perfected mm-hmm. by black America.
For the most part, yeah, I would agree with that.
No, not for the most part.
As a jazz musician...
You play shitty jazz.
That's a horribly racist thing to say. But let me differentiate on that musical art form. Let me differentiate swing and big band music. So if you look at Glenn Miller and big band music was very scripted and well thought out.
Yeah, I don't think of that as
true jazz, which I have played, and I'm not saying I've played it well, but I have actually played it. True jazz, you get this head sheet or this header sheet or whatever, and it basically has the basic melody of the music. And you've got a bridge, and then you have this place where you do the improvisation.
Yeah, what I heard from a jazz musician was that, you know, the key to jazz is you know what you're supposed to play. Mm-hmm. And knowing what you're supposed to play, you can play anything.
Yeah.
And that's not talking about free jazz, which is its own thing, or free improvisation, which is its own thing. But like the birth of cool jazz, mm-hmm. right? Which was all, it was all standards. It was all vocal standards.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't all, but it was vocal standards turned into these...
things
these
with a big improvisational
jazz
section.
Jazz workouts. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that requires you to get out there, to find something new, to push your brain to the limit.
To not be frightened either.
Right. And it requires what I like to call something that Lou Lefton and I do, on the scientific end, divergent thinking, something different. You know, now they call it outside the box, but it's really divergent thinking, where you do something new and different. And actually, comedians do this as well. Sometimes your best bits were an improvised rant with an audience member at a club, and then you turn that into a
structure. Todd Berry released that album that's just crowd work.
Yeah. I know some comedians that do predominantly crowd work. Steve Hofstetter, I'm a big fan of. He does a lot of really good.
Had him on the show.
Crowd work. Some people claim he's mean to people. He wails on hecklers. But I got to tell you, it's pretty fun to watch. I've seen it live. And, you know, he's the kind of guy that comes into a club and convinces both the feature and the MC who goes on before him not to do any standard material. And this is always like the late night Sunday show or something like that. But it's pretty fun. And that's what jazz is. And the question is, I assume that artists who try to do that, you know, if you're an artist who yes. So that's why if you're a classical artist, it's the idea of reproducing with enviable fidelity, you know, Mozart's, you know, particular symphony, then you're right. You're not divergent. But if you want to take it to the next level, if you want to do something new and creative, I think a lot of people look to drugs or whatever to put you in that mood so that you can do that sort of thing.
Put you in the mood. What do you think of when you think of the mood?
No, the mood is to be uninhibited.
Yeah.
And let's be honest. Okay, let's take alcohol as an example. You know, people make fun of the three martini lunch for businessmen. My father was a businessman. My father probably had five martini lunches. That's how they closed sales. But if you're really going to push it to the limit, different people like different things to help them get there. And let's be honest, you're very nervous. You're meeting with a group that you've never met before. Most of us would say you have one or two drinks and it will sort of, you know, smooth the path for you to interact with those folks. When I was in Russia, I was one of the only Americans at this big technical summit. There were like two other Americans, and I hung out with the Germans. They were a party group. And we were all worried about this, you know, in Russia, if you open a bottle of vodka, you have to finish it. But they're small bottles. They're not a whole fifth. They're actually half that size or less. So if you got four or five guys, yeah, it's a couple shots apiece. You know, so that's okay. Yeah. You can do, and that's what I'm saying. It helped us all interact a little bit better. And that's nothing more than self-medication. And whether you're doing other drugs or not. So let me give you a good example. A guy by the name of Ron Schock, who, very funny guy, very nice guy. He died of cancer a few years back. He said to me, and I don't think this is a secret, so I don't think I'm dissing his memory at all. He was a headliner the night that I was voted second funniest office worker in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. I remember that now, yeah.
And this is a guy who does a little bit of marijuana every time he gets up there. And that's, you know, what helps him relax to the point where he can do it. I think that's dangerous.
Whoa, that's the thing right there, yeah. Right? Relax to so that you can do it, whatever it
his
is.
His creative process, yeah. Now, that could be dangerous because I know other comedians, and I'm not going to mention a good friend of mine who's a really funny comedian, who recently cleaned up his act. He used to have to chug three or four beers before he went on stage. He used to have to be drunk to perform. Now he's looking good. He's lost some weight. He's in shape. I saw him perform. Actually, he performed here a little while ago.
I know who that is.
Yeah, this is the guy who used the F word more than anyone in the library at Georgia Tech. And I'm so glad to see that he now is this way. No, and the point is, if he had to have one drink, and there are times when I perform, I don't like to drink before I perform. I want to be on my game. But if I'm particularly nervous, you know, you have one drink, that'll help you relax enough. But if you have four, you know, then I think you're getting sloppy. And I don't think that's good. So my question is, I assume this was part of the artist process, that this is what you do. And the question is, do scientists trying to seek that creative spark, and let's face it, if you're doing research, you are, do they do the same thing? I assumed it was less.
Let's not forget Simon, who was a library regular, and said that whenever he checked a closed circuit, he drank a beer before he checked the closed circuit. You're a terrible podcaster. Pete
did he ever get electrocuted because he was drunk?
Pete,
I remember
did
this
the
story.
Exact wrong thing when he took a sip of his soda there.
I swallowed in the lull. No, that's good. George Carlin did a whole bit on that. I think that's a funny bit. But do me a favor. Bring up, we've got the 10 scientists and technological visionaries who experimented with drugs. Bring up Kerry Mullis, who we can relate to at Georgia Tech because he actually has an appointment here in some respect. So what does it say? Can you read that for me? Oh, people are asking, who is Kerry Mullis? You don't know your science if you don't know who Kerry Mullis is.
Who, you may be asking, is Kerry Mullis? Let's put it this way. If you've worked in a biomedical research lab since the 1980s, there's an exceedingly good chance you've performed a polymerase chain reaction.
Polymerase chain reaction.
Polymerase.
Won him the Nobel Prize.
A lab technique that can turn a single segment of DNA into millions of identical copies. And you have Mullis to thank for that. He improved upon that technique and earned a Nobel Prize. He says he took plenty of LSD in the 60s and 70s, called his mind-opening experimentation with psychedelics much more important than any course I ever took. So, there you go.
He claims, I heard him in an interview, because of course when he won the Nobel Prize, and since he has some sort of affiliation with tech, we're like, hey, you know, everybody tries to take credit for this. He supposedly claimed that the polymerase chain reaction idea came to him when he was driving down the Pacific Coast Highway, and he had some weed in his system.
So I think when you talk about the comedians who have to get a little bit drunk to get on stage, that is the... allowing yourself to, well, to be courageous. You have to get past fear of doing something, and you have to stop your fear from stopping you from doing what you want to do.
Right.
Right, from the performance, which is public and which is at a particular time.
No, but that's reducing anxiety. It can also make you more creative. That's what I'm saying.
It can't, but with Carey Mullis, he's saying that he did drugs at times that then just in general opened himself up for the ideas to come bubbling up. Right? But they are kind of the same thing. To stop oneself from getting in one's way.
Yeah, that's exactly it. To improve your creativity by facilitating divergent thinking.
He said divergent thinking a couple times. What is divergent thinking?
To me, divergent thinking... So Lou and I use humor to encourage divergent thinking. Basically, if you sit around and whether you're an engineer or an artist, it doesn't really matter, you're thinking, well, how can I do this? And you go back to what you know, right? You look at familiar patterns in your brain. So, say I'm going to create a new pump. And as a chemical engineer, I think, well, there are positive displacement pumps, and there are centrifugal pumps, and there are, you know, all sorts of different pumps. And you think about those, and could I use those or a combination thereof? And you never get out of those because that's the reference point for you. But if you think, you know, like Einstein, when he was thinking about general relativity, what if light doesn't bend? What if space does?
Which is
that's a divergent thought.
The structure of a stereotypical stoner thought.
No, that's exactly no. What if?
This change the voice, and suddenly you have a joke.
Michael Keaton's Billy Blaze from Night Shift. Okay, what if we fed the mayonnaise to the tuna? Note to self: call StarKist. That's divergent thinking. What if we did? It's the what if questions. And sometimes we get in our own way because we have all this previous knowledge. And so say you're a jazz musician and you think to yourself, well, jazz chords go in a 3-5-7 chord pattern.
You have those sort of standard ways that your fingers move or the way you think of a melody.
Yeah, we think of grace notes and we think of arpeggios.
You want to improvise in such a way that you don't do what you did before. Yeah. And that's in everything, right?
And guys like Miles Davis said, well, what if we abandoned that 3-5-7 and we did something that's just stayed in a key for a while? And that's how modal jazz was formed. And Miles Davis plays it. I think there are a lot of people responsible for inventing it, though. But modal jazz is a different kind of jazz. It's a jazz I prefer to play because it's easier. All you got to do is in the same key. I'll admit that. But think about it. Some of the classics on Kind of Blue came out of that. So the question is, you know, how do you get yourself in that state? Lou and I make a lot of jokes, and if you make jokes, you're being a little bit irreverent. Nobody really cares. You're allowed to say crazy things, and then no one has a hangover the next morning. Whereas drugs can do the same thing, and let's admit it will reduce inhibitions.
Yeah.
So if it reduces inhibitions socially, which is how most people use it, it will also reduce inhibitions with regard to you thinking of new and interesting things.
Drugs that cause hallucinations or sort of mess with your thought process also, I think, can give you a model for a different way to think, a different way to approach ideas.
Different, outside the box, divergent.
Yeah. But even more than like...
Don't operate heavy machinery when you're doing any of these
things. Even more than divergent thinking, like on the topic, I mean, if you've experienced that kind of fractured perception that can come from serious psychedelics, right, then you probably have a different attitude toward absurdity and non sequitur kind of thinking. Or you might even be more tuned into how sometimes things just don't seem to connect. Like, you know, you try to make a narrative of your day. Oh, it was the worst day I ever had. It's like, oh, what a great day. As opposed to maybe being in the moment. Like, what is this experience? What is this thing happening? You know, and not then trying to smooth out your experience into an easily Pete is starting to smile now. Like, what are you smiling about?
I'm
going to
quote Agent Smith from the movie?
Matrix.
The Matrix. Well, Mr. Anderson, you're talking about people that never thought things fit quite together, and so you're saying there are people that are predisposed to thinking outside the box, and maybe this just helps them.
I'm sure there are people who are predisposed, but then also, like, if you take acid, and you go through an acid trip, you come out the other side, you've experience things in a way that you never had before, and many people don't. I mean, statistically, I think very few people have done acid. you know, like
actually,
like,
when I was a graduate student at MIT, that was the drug of choice among undergraduates. Some guy left a micro dot in my polymer science lab.
But that sample was very particular, right?
Was it particular?
No. The
lysergic acid diethylamide. It's very. It's one thing.
Come back to me, Pete. You said the people you knew in California. That sample,
right?
Of that you were polling. Mm-hmm. Right, it was a very particular kind of sample. It wasn't a...
No, this is New England. This was Boston. This was MIT.
I thought you just said California.
No.
My mistake.
But a good friend of mine...
That school. Yeah. I mean, school, right? Come on. Yeah. That's where the drugs are.
Yeah, colleges. Okay,
and
I'll give you that.
And restaurant kitchens. and so...
All right, can you go back to that? I want to hear what it said about Carl Sagan.
Okay.
He was a big hero of mine.
By the way, everybody, this is from io9.com, 10 scientific and technological visionaries who experimented with drugs. And experimentation is a rather loose term. Preeminent astrophysicist and cosmologist Carl Sagan not only smoked marijuana regularly, he was also a strong advocate for its use in enhancing intellectual pursuits.
Oh, so at first I thought because he died of cancer that maybe he did it when he had chemotherapy. Okay, well, good for you, Carl.
Sagan did contribute an essay to the 1971 book titled Marijuana Reconsidered that spoke to the virtues of marijuana use. You can read that piece here, it says. You know, I think that there are some drugs that people feel when they do them that, like, this is the way to live. This is the good stuff. And there are some that people take and they're like, okay, well, that was rough. I'm glad I did it, kind of, but I'll never do it again, and I wouldn't suggest it to anybody.
Like syrup of Epicac.
and then there are...
I'm glad it's around in case you swallow poison. But there was a reality show on a number of years ago where they had... I'm sure it was a solution of syrup of Epicac. It was just pure syrup of Epicac. It's a real problem. And it was... They maybe had a few ounces of it. It was sitting in a little, you know, sort of plastic polyester water bottle. And they were going to give people like $500 if they would chug this whole several ounces down. Ugh. And this was easily enough to induce vomiting. Syrup of Epicac is what you take to induce vomiting. And
podcast is going to induce vomiting for me.
These macho guys are, yeah, I'll do it. $500, come on. That's not chump change.
You get to keep it if you throw up.
Because
people $500 for the
just
effect.
Taking it, just okay. taking it. So people are like, yeah, that's not so bad. And literally 20 seconds later, you were just hurling your guts out because it's a reflexive thing. It's kind of like Pitocin when they induce labor. It automatically starts the contractions. And if the contraction is in your stomach with syrup of Epicac, it's just coming up no matter what. But it's a pretty violent contraction. It's not pleasant. So I would not do that for $5,000. Well, maybe $5,000, but not $1,000.
I would throw up for $5,000.
Yeah, but it's a really bad.
I've thrown up for free. I've paid to throw up in the past. So there are supplementary. There are daily drugs that are supplementary to one's existence.
Yeah, caffeine. Right? I'm drinking some iced tea now.
Some people get high all the time. Doug Benson is a very popular stoner comedian, and his activism is. Mostly gentle. He's done a couple, you know, movies and but he mostly just kind of pushes like, yeah, you know, I'm high all the time and it's great. Okay. That's how I like to be. There are people who seek...
But for his profession, which is fundamentally creative, that's okay. If you're an engineer and you do require precision calculations, like I often am called to do,
but
that's not going to work.
That's why you have one of these, right? A computer. That's important. Yeah. Or a graduate assistant.
But to be honest, I will say that you do get some good creativity when you are a little chemically uninhibited. And whether that's marijuana or alcohol, I agree with Carl Sagan. I think it should be decriminalized.
So is there a point here? I mean, did we get anywhere? Or do you
I think what we're saying is we don't think that there is a significant difference between
scientists should get high.
Scientists and...
is that the that's
and
the
artists?
Answer. They should definitely.
No,
I'm
are we
gonna
saying,
cut
no,
your mic.
I don't think we're saying that. But I think we're saying here's what I'm saying is for centuries we have used alcohol to reduce our inhibitions in either social situations or for creativity purposes. I don't see much of a difference between that and other drugs. I really don't, particularly marijuana. And I was just telling you, I spent my half of my set at the 420 Festival telling weed jokes like everyone else did. Everybody told weed jokes because it's the 420 Festival. But I told them from the standpoint of education. On a practical note, I think it's ridiculous to spend billions of dollars to go after a guy growing a weed in his garage. And on a more fundamental note, I am very angry at the National Football League.
Why?
Because so I did some research before I did my Denver tour about cannabinoids and actually changing
and where the best place to buy some is. And
well, yeah, the dispensary is very easy.
Do I want the White Widow from Afghanistan?
I don't understand all those names.
Or the Wavy Gravy from Humboldt County.
They take the oil and they put it on like gummy worms and gummy bears.
I believe those are called edibles.
They are called edibles, yes. And I'm a big fan of edibles because smoking is bad for you. Now I sound like your grandfather. Hey, kids. But the carbon compounds, the tars.
It is straight up bad for you.
It's bad for you. So what we have done recently is we've applied modern principles of drug delivery to these things. So, for example, the e-cigarettes.
Turns out staying up late's bad for you, too.
It is. So you shouldn't do it all the time.
And also, e-cigarettes are worse.
Why are e-cigarettes worse?
The formaldehyde.
Oh, is there formaldehyde in those things?
Like in the vape stuff.
Well, formaldehyde is not good for you in general. But, no, it's not.
That's why they save it up for the end.
People develop serious allergies to formaldehyde. But what's interesting is you take the drug that you like, and the drug that people like is nicotine, which, by the way, is not devoid of long-term bad health effects for you. Nicotine can lead to diffuse coronary artery disease and all sorts of things. But at least you're getting rid of one part. You're getting rid of both the tars that are really bad for you and the ammonia gas that paralyzes. I got to look into that. Formaldehyde is not good. But it also produces ammonia gas that paralyzes the cilia and your sinuses and your respiratory system that filter out some of those carbon compounds. But now they just take cannabis oil and mix it in there as well. So they make an e-cigarette that works that way. And a good friend of mine, a comedian, Jeremy, was explaining the whole principle to me at the 420 Festival. But at least you're getting rid of the carbon things. Here's my problem with the NFL. Most people take painkillers based on opiates. These come from the opium poppy, right? The derivative of heroin. These are things like morphine. And they're very, very effective. But if you take them for 30-plus years,
they are not effective
they
anymore.
They will ruin your liver and kill you for the most part. And that's a real problem. And I know what you're thinking. You know, who takes painkillers for 30-plus years? The AMA has a name for this class. They call them former NFL athletes.
Right.
You know, you mess up your body enough that it can be a problem. My mom recently passed away, and she was in severe pain due to some osteoarthritis, maybe a little bit of rheumatoid arthritis toward the end. And it's very harsh on your system. Now, there are those that claim that cannabinoids, which is a sort of a different functional group, are not as hard on your liver. I haven't seen really long-term studies on that, but the joke I made at the festival was that the long-term study that indicates it's not as hard on your system as opioids is Willie Nelson. And think about it. Everybody knows an old stoner. Do you know an old stoner?
I know
lots of old stoners. Do you know an old heroin addict?
No.
No. There you go. So that's anecdotal evidence, but we probably should do some research on that.
I know old reformed heroin addicts.
Okay, exactly. And the NFL.
And it did look for a little while there like William S. Burroughs was going to outlast us all. And Keith Richards, still trucking.
Still tricking, but I'm not going to see the Stones when they come to Atlanta.
Me neither.
Because I just think they're too old. How good is that concert going to be?
You know how I figured it out, how I wasn't going to go see the Stones?
Because the tickets were too expensive?
No, because I saw the Stones.
You saw them when they were good, when they were young.
Well, not even that. I saw the Stones, and people were like, I think they might be too old to tour. And that was in 1991.
Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK Studios on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia.
Those institutions support these views?
Probably not.
But they might.
If they were drinking.